Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is a Canadian-British blogger, journalist and science fiction author. He's held policy positions with Creative Commons and the Electronic Frontier Foundation and been a Fulbright Fellow at the University of Southern California. He's a co-editor of one of the most influential blogs in the world, Boing Boing. His science fiction has won numerous awards and spent several weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Cory Doctorow is my guest on Meet the Writers. Now, we recorded this conversation in Australia. We were both there participating in Adelaide Writers Week. I started by asking Cory how important it is for him to get out to meet readers, given that so much of his life is lived online.
So, you know, it's a funny question because it's one that's really become sharply defined for me in the last year. It wasn't a question on which I took a view until pretty recently. Last year, a friend of mine, Patrick Ball, wrote an essay about how the most suicidal demographic in North America is well-set-up, middle-class, middle-aged white men. His thesis about why this happens is that if you lack privilege, then the only way you can possibly survive is through social capital. You can't pay a babysitter every time you need to go out, so you have to have a neighbor that you're on good terms with who might look after your kids and vice versa. You can't just have an overdraft when money runs out at the end of the month. You have to find someone who lends you a fiver. That mesh of social relations, these weak ties, as the sociologists say, creates a kind of resilient backstop for your low moments, for the times when things just aren't going well. It's the people who just casually notice when you're going a bit off the rails. And if you have privilege, then you can turn all of those non-deterministic, messy social interactions into deterministic transactions. Just pay for a babysitter, pay for your overdraft, so on. And it's a system that works very well and fails very badly. It works well in the sense that every time you pay a babysitter, plus or minus, a babysitter turns up. It fails badly because if all of your relations are transactional, no one is there to catch on when things are going off the rails. I had spoken to Patrick about this essay. He published it online and he brought it to Burning Man, where there's a temple that commemorates people who died. It burns on the last night, and every year for the last several years it's commemorated people we've known who've killed themselves. And so we got to talking about it, and then I started to look around at my own life and realize that I'd managed to get myself into a pretty deep well of trouble, in the sense that I've become very socially isolated. I work in my garage, so my commute is 1 minute. In an average day, I'll talk to my wife, my daughter, the lifeguard at the pool where I swim, and the barista, and that's it. And so that degree of social isolation, while it was incredible for my productivity, working my bum off without anyone interrupting with any kind of messy social stuff, it failed very badly, because with the stress of the Trump election and all the other things going on in the world, it was getting harder and harder to feel resilient. And I started to very deliberately find times to go and meet people face to face, not necessarily for a drink, maybe to walk their dogs in Griffith Park or something else, but very explicitly to set up, I think of it as the grown-up equivalent of the skin-to-skin contact that's become kind of very important in postnatal care, where the first thing they do is put the newborn on the mother's chest. You know, there's something about being in someone else's presence, shaking their hands, locking eyes. Patrick thinks that church does a lot of this, that historically the way that people who were purely transactional kept themselves out of trouble was by weekly getting together with a cross-section of their community, singing together, moving together, shaking hands, making eye contact, commemorating births and deaths and marriages, and that in combination, this constituted a set of weak ties that could cushion all the worst blows.
You could take that idea, and indeed you have taken that idea of social capital one step further when you talk about digital reputation. So Woofy is something that you have invented. Tell us about that.
So it was a semi-satirical thought experiment about a semi-dystopian society based on reputation capital that was mistaken for both utopian and prescriptive, as in, you should go and build this. So in this novel I wrote, my first published novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, in 2003, I posit a society in which all of the wants of the human race have been met. We live forever. We have an infinite amount of energy. We can place ourselves in suspended animation for arbitrary lengths of time, which means we can explore the stars because we can just park our metabolism for 1,000 years while we sail between the stars. And the few stubbornly scarce things are things like someone wants to introduce you to a friend of theirs and do you want to give them the time of day? Or there's a great restaurant, who gets to eat there? Or who gets to run the restaurant and accumulate all of the social capital that comes from having a great restaurant that everyone likes to eat in? And so Woofie is this kind of running score that anyone can see that reflects how much esteem the people you know hold any person that you encounter. And when someone comes up and asks you, can I introduce you to a friend of mine, that score impinges your view of whether or not you'll say yes. But by the same token, if there's a restaurant and someone turns up and says, I'm the maitre d', and everyone who looks at them looks at their Woofie score and says, they seem pretty reputable, then you become the maitre d'. And it's about these people who take over Walt Disney World and start to contest the validity of whose vision should be in place in the rides and attractions of Walt Disney World. And because the key to immortality in this book is that you can save the state of your consciousness, and if you die, you can have a new body grown very quickly and that consciousness decanted into it, recreational assassination becomes just a form of rhetoric. And so if someone's really upsetting you, just kill them, because then they can be restored to another body the next morning, and it's just a way of like forcefully making a point.
You're a man of extraordinary ideas, and I want to just go back to the beginning and find out where they all come from. So you're of Azerbaijani extraction.
Not quite. My grandmother was a Russian child soldier who, after they evacuated the children from the Leningrad during the siege, met my grandfather, who was Belarusian. They both were inducted into the Red Army, deserted, and went to Azerbaijan to live in a displaced persons camp, and that's where my father was born. So I'm not ethnically Azeri, but my father was born in Baku. I like to say that I'm half Asian, which, like, I think is a really interesting debate about what we mean when we say Asian, but I'm in no way Asian in any of the ways that you think, except for the one where my father was born in Asia, and he contributed half of my genes.
And so where did you grow up?
In Toronto, Canada.
Tell me about your childhood, your education.
My parents are both teachers. I went to publicly funded alternative schools that were very free-flowing, self-directed. I ended up enjoying high school so much, I spent 7 years there. I took a year out to write. I took a year out to organize protests against the first Gulf War, and then went to uni. I dropped out of 4 universities, never got an undergraduate degree. The last university I dropped out of, I had submitted a thesis proposal for an undergraduate degree that had a final year thesis. They rejected the thesis proposal because they didn't want something presented in hypertext. I got a job offer to be a hypertext programmer for an early CD-ROM pioneer called Voyager in New York. And so I weighed up the stay here, pay you, don't make hypertext, quit, go work for this glamorous firm in New York, get paid more than I ever have to make hypertext. And that was just an easy call. I think it was the right one.
That obviously has taken you into a life of technology.
I was always very technological. My father is a computer scientist. His master's degree was in what was called applied mathematics at the time, which subsequently became computer science. So we were one of those families that had terminals connected to mainframes in the mid-70s in our kitchen. Without a screen, we had a roll of brown paper towel that my mother would nick from the toilets at the elementary school where she was working. We'd get 1,000 feet of paper towel, and you could compute for 1,000 feet. And then when it ran out, you could turn it over, and then you couldn't compute anymore until you had more paper. And so I've always been very technological. I always say to people that if you really want a good job in tech, you should have the foresight and good judgment to be born in 1971, straddling the generation of the pre-ubiquitous computing and post-ubiquitous computing, being even marginally skilled in computers at a time when industry was crying out for anyone who knew anything and was willing to train. That was a really powerful set of forces. In the same way that, you know, Londoners who were lucky enough to, like, buy a house because they needed somewhere to live in, like, 1985, and then they flogged it 20 years later for £2 million more than they paid for it, sometimes fancy themselves to be incredibly clued-in property investors, but in fact are just riding a demographic wave. Anyone who's my age who made a living in technology just got lucky by when they were born.
And so tell me about that progression through making a living in tech.
I started off as a software developer, then I became an internet developer, so first developing for a platform that predated the web called Gopher, and then web developer, and then I started to take on a sort of CIO role for a lot of different firms that were discovering that they were becoming more technologically involved. They'd historically had a passing relationship with technology, things like documentary film houses or prepress houses or advertising firms, marketing firms, that suddenly the center of their business, rather than it being a utility function of like someone needs to keep the computers running, suddenly it was everything to how they worked. I started to become a kind of CIO for hire. I started a software company during the dot-com bubble, raised a bunch of money in the capital markets, and then quit and went to work for an NGO that worked on issues related to surveillance and privacy on the internet. And around that time, I started writing for a website that I came to be co-owner of called Boing Boing. That's a kind of technology and culture website. It's a very eclectic place to write for and to read. The way that we work it is that anything that seems in any way significant to any of us, we try to write up for a third party, a notional stranger who we're trying to communicate what it was about this news story or this gadget or this editorial or someone's interesting art project that caught our attention. We try to explain why it seems significant. And rather than the traditional model of magazine publishing, which is to identify an audience that someone wants to advertise for and then hire people to write material that that audience might want to read, we wrote for people who might have the same interest as us. And as millions and millions of them aggregated around the website, we began to find advertisers who wanted to advertise to those people. So it was really the other way around. It's a very salutary way of working because you really just pursue your interests. And in terms of the fiction and other work I do, having this real-time running open notebook of everything that seems like it might be part of something bigger is a very useful thing. On the one hand, I get this searchable database of everything I ever thought was useful. On the other hand, it gets annotated by my readers who come along and comment on it and suggest further material. And then finally, the act of writing it up for an audience is itself mnemonic and helps me remember it and helps me find connections where I hadn't suspected them. And so every now and again, you know, this kind of super saturated solution of fragmentary ideas will have a couple of fragments that nucleate and crystallize into a story or a novel or a speech or an essay.
Mm-hmm. Where would you classify where media is right now, and then where you think the old style of media, the media that most of us consume, is going?
So on the one hand, media has historically been very polarized. In the UK, obviously, we have newspapers that are explicitly affiliated with political positions and even with parties. I mean, The Independent is called The Independent because it was at one point the only newspaper that didn't have a party affiliation. And on the other hand, we have a very long tradition of extremely polarized news. I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda just became one of the best known artists in the world for retelling the story of that time that someone wrote an op-ed and someone else killed him over it. This is Hamilton, right? So neither of those things are new. Nor are technological shocks that news media have had to endure. The advents of mechanized printing and radio, telegraphs, television, film reels, and so on, all of those things visited enormous technological shocks upon the news media, and the news media has weathered it. Now, in hindsight, it may seem a lot more bloodless than it was. All the people whose lives were destroyed by radio because they had an honorable career in newspaper, those people don't get to tell their story because they languish in obscurity. But at the same time, it seems really clear that the newspapers were able to emerge one time after another, or the news media was able to emerge one time after another, despite these technological shocks. But a bunch of things happens around the same time the news came along. So first of all, the historic model for newspapers in the U.S. has been that your town newspaper was in fact primarily a vehicle to sell white goods to people who wanted to look at sports scores. And so the majority of people who paid for the news just wanted to look at sports scores. The reason that they were able to buy a newspaper for 25 cents instead of $1.50, which would have been way beyond the point that they were willing to pay for their sports scores, was that white goods manufacturers would pay to reach people who wanted to see sports scores. The families who owned those newspapers would feel a kind of sense of patrician duty to the towns that they were reporting on, and they would take a little bit of the excess capital from selling white goods to sports fans and pay reporters to go sit in town council meetings and write about what was going on. That was the majority of news consumption until pretty recently. Almost no one has ever paid for news per se, especially political news, especially local political news. It's just not been a thing that people paid for. Around the time the internet started to kick off, was also around the time that we saw the maturity of the neoliberal policies of Thatcher, Reagan, Mulroney in Canada, and so on, where all of the antitrust checks and balances that would have prevented a single entity from owning multiple news organs in the same market, or all the newspapers in a country, or all the newspapers in a city, or newspapers in television, or whatever, all of those checks and balances were stripped away, and media companies were able to buy up a whole ton of newspapers and then strip mine them so they could flog off their capital assets. They could literally sell the printing presses of newspapers and then lease them back. They could fire all of their staff and hire them back as contractors. They could sell their buildings, which were typically sitting on really plum real estate in large cities that were going through real estate bubbles. All of that left them, on the one hand, it paid these big dividends to the shareholders, right? They got these one-time dividends from liquidating the capital assets, but it left them very vulnerable to shocks, because if rents went up, then they had to pay higher rent, right? They didn't get to say, well, rents are going up for everyone who didn't have the foresight to buy a giant building in Farringdon or whatever, but not for us. We had the foresight to buy this building. We just get to sit here. We ride out those highs and lows. So it made them very vulnerable to shocks. And at the same time, classified advertising through newspapers was not the best way of doing it. It was just the least worst. And so that was a shock that was always going to be hard to weather. And Craigslist definitely does a better job of selling white goods to sports fans than newspapers ever did. But the idea a priori that the news media never could have weathered that shock, that it was something distinct about the internet and not about multinational neoliberal capitalism with the gloves off, that killed news media, that I think is a fallacy. Mm-hmm. They say if you're not paying for it, you're the product. What we see in an era of unregulated monopolism is that people who are paying for it are still the product, right? You buy your iPhone or you buy your Android phone, and it's full of surveillance technology that is spying on everything you do. It's selling information about your habits to third parties, and you bought it, right? It's yours. If you're a farmer and you drive your $500,000 John Deere tractor around your back field, it's gathering telemetry on your field. It knows what your soil density is because of the torque sensors in the wheels. It knows about the humidity of the soil because of the sensors in the undercarriage. But you can't get that data. Monsanto takes that data, sells it back to you with Monsanto seed, and John Deere takes the data and aggregates it and sells it into the futures market, where people who are making bets on crop yields use it. So even if you're spending $500,000 on the product, you're still the product. Mm-hmm. So this idea that advertising is the original sin, I think, is very poorly thought through. In an era of gross wealth inequality, if you imagine a world in which you had to pay to read the news, what you get is not a world in which everyone gets better news. What you end up with is a world in which most people can't afford to be informed.
You've expanded these ideas further in your book, all about why the internet should be free.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, which is it's the punchline of a joke. So Stuart Brand, very famously at the first Hackers Conference in 1984, was having this conversation with Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple. And he said, on the one hand, information wants to be expensive. And on the other hand, information wants to be free. And this has been held up as a rallying cry. No one should have to pay for information. Everything should be free on the internet. People who like the internet thinks that everything should be free and so on. I think that the reality is that in the 21st century, we live in an information society where, when Martha Lane Fox was the champion for digital inclusion in the Lib Dem Tory coalition government, she commissioned a PwC study of two council estates, one of which had been given the internet through a pilot program and the one next door hadn't, and so it was a kind of natural experiment. And what they found was that a few years on, the people who lived in the housing estate where there was internet had better outcomes in education, in health, in employment, in civic and public participation, in political participation, and so on. You know, the internet is the nervous system of the 21st century, and information doesn't want to be free, but people do. And if you don't have a free, fair, and open information infrastructure, then you can't be free.
All of your own fiction is free, it's shareable online. Do you think that the open source sharing of information improves the creative experience for writers and for readers, and would strict laws stifle that expression?
Almost all of my work is available that way. I've had publishers who've vetoed it for a couple of books. So just to be clear, it's almost everything is available that way. I think that there will never be a time that we can imagine in which acquiring information without paying for it, if you choose not to, will be harder than it is today, right? There will never be a time in which hard drives are less capacious or more expensive than they are now. There'll never be a time in which networks are slower or in which search is worse. There will never be a time in which fewer OAPs have been retrained at their local library to type movie namespace BitTorrent into Google if they choose not to watch a movie. And so in that world, every payment for creative work is ultimately a voluntary payment. Anyone who really doesn't want to pay doesn't have to. And the likelihood of being caught in any kind of enforcement mechanism is so close to zero as makes no damn. So there's almost no rational expectation of having any kind of consequence visited on you if you choose not to pay. And so in that world, you need to find a way to convince people to pay. And one of the ways that we've tried to do it is through coercion, right? We try to scare people. We make the consequences of taking material without paying extremely dire. Peter Mandelson famously cooked up this idea where he would get to be the Lord High Executioner of the internet in Britain. And if you were accused of three acts of copyright infringement without proof, you and everyone who lived in your house would be disconnected from the internet for a year or 2 years or 3 years. You know, and the idea is to kind of say, well, maybe we won't catch you, likely we won't, but if we do, it will be so dire that you really don't want to be caught, so you better keep your nose clean. That has been like grossly ineffective at stopping people from infringing copyright. And the other way of doing it is through moral suasion. It's to try and make the case that all other things being equal, the best thing to do is to pay the artist because that produces an outcome that everyone's happy with. The artist gets to earn a living and make more work that you love. The money isn't unduly captured by third parties who didn't contribute materially to the work, such as intermediaries like Amazon or payment processors, or in some cases, big studios that have been just sort of squatting on the rights to the work for years and years. And that moral suasion is the thing I think that a more liberal regime of licensing for your work helps you with. It keeps people in the tent pissing out instead of out of the tent pissing in. I think that overbroad copyright laws, they do have an effect on creative work in the sense that creators are plunderers. There's a hilarious moment in Kirby Dick's movie, This Film Is Not Yet Rated. It's a documentary about how the motion picture rating system is completely opaque and very corrupt. So it's run by the Big Five studios. They say that their raters are parents of young children and that they only serve for a year or two and then they get rotated out and that they meet in secret and that they treat studio movies and independent movies in the same way. And he hires private eyes to follow them around and find out who they are. And what he finds is that it's actually a bunch of studio executive spouses, that they hold the job for life, that they treat the studios with favor and independents with less favor, and that they are extremely averse to any kind of queer sexuality. And so you can have someone murdering children by the busload, and that will show up with a rating that lets people under 18 into the cinema, but have a bloke kissing another bloke, and it'll have a rating that's so restrictive no cinematic exhibitor will put it on a screen. And so he submits this to the ratings board. He follows the ratings board around. He gets all of their identities. He makes a movie about it and submits it to the ratings board. And they're watching this movie and their own pictures turn up. And so the next part of the movie is he gets a phone call from the CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America in DC, who says, I've just seen your movie and I want to talk to you about it. And he says, how did you see my movie in Washington, DC when I submitted it to the ratings board in LA? And this guy says, well, we made a copy. Well, I never authorized you to make a copy. And he said, well, don't worry, I put it in my vault. Well, you know, on the one hand, that's ridiculous. They just sued thousands of movie fans for watching movies. If all of those movie fans had had vaults, would they have decided not to sue them? But on the other hand, it shows you that the normal business of creating involves making lots of copies without authorization. So it's bad for artists. But what it's really bad for, when we get into proposals like, everything that goes on YouTube is going to be surveilled to make sure that it doesn't infringe copyright. And if we think that you're infringing copyright, we'll suppress it. If we get into proposals like every click on a campus network has to be surveilled to make sure it's not going to a torrent website, or, you know, Peter Mandelson's idea that if you infringe copyright three times, we disconnect you from the internet, or even if you're accused of it three times, we disconnect you, then what you see is the single wire that delivers free speech and a free press and free assembly and all of the other benefits that we ascribe to a civilized society is being subsumed to this regime that is really about regulating the internal business of the entertainment industry, which is itself a pretty fringe business that only a few people work in. And that's so lopsided. And it brings the whole idea of copyright into disrepute. You know, I'm all for having a set of rules for regulating the industry that I'm a participant in. And I can't imagine a way of bringing it into greater and quicker disrepute than saying that, like, those rules should also be the dominant rule set that you have to follow when you're doing anything on the internet, because it all involves making copies, whether you're voting or writing to your MP or getting an education or falling in love. And that's ridiculous.
What are you working on next?
I'm writing a third Little Brother novel for adults. The first two were young adult novels, and I'm sort of aging up with the audience. It's called Crypto Wars. I have a novella I've just finished that's sort of in limbo. There's been some back and forth with the publisher, but I expect that we'll see something soon, and I'm looking forward to making that announcement. There's something firm shaping up with it. A little bit of screenwriting, a short story about Superman intervening in the beating of an African-American man in New York, who then discovers that his whiteness and indeed his humanity are purely socially constructed, and once he's on the wrong side of the NYPD, he can be reconfigured in an instant as an illegal immigrant. And then the next thing I'm going to write is a short story about respectable middle-class people who've been denied cover for their life-threatening illnesses, or who've had to watch their children die because they were denied cover for life-threatening illnesses in the American private healthcare system, who are radicalized on the internet and become suicide bombers who blow up healthcare executives.
I think that might be something that could happen.
So I'm a father. As we say this, my 10-year-old is in the other room, and when I imagine her being denied life-saving care by an insurer who we've been paying, I can imagine it. I cannot imagine ever resting if that were to happen. And honestly, what do you have to lose at that point? Once some distant healthcare executive or politician on the take has been complicit in the murder of your child, what do you have to lose? I'm amazed that we do not hear about daily suicide bombings of congressmen, of senators, of healthcare executives. Now, to be very clear, I'm not endorsing this. I think that it's not the right way to change hearts and minds. It's not a proportionate response. I just can see how it would happen. And I think that, like, it's actually probably a vote of enormous confidence in the human race that we have the fundamental goodness that even in those moments of extremis, people still have the forbearance not to strap some fertilizer onto their backs and walk into, Cigna or Blue Shield.
Very quickly, your career high, your career low?
I suck at best ofs and worst ofs. I am much more the guy who has 1,000 books than the guy who has one. I think people who have one favorite thing get into trouble. Like, you know, that Pol Pot seems like a really smart fellow. I don't know that we need to listen to anyone else. There have been lots of highs and lots of lows. The highs are unfortunately short-lived. I think it's probably a personality defect that a lot of people have, that it's a lot easier to focus on the times when things are going wrong than when they're going right. And you know, the way I try to think about it and maybe let myself off the hook a little, or at least be kind to myself about it, is it doesn't matter how good the punch is if there's a turd floating in the punch bowl. So, you know, very hard to ignore that turd, no matter how delicious the punch is. The lows are the lows, right? It's just not getting what you wanted. It's the book that you had hopes for not selling as well as you thought it would. It's a critic being mean. My friend Stephen Bruce, who's a wonderful writer, says that telling someone that they wrote a bad book is like telling them that they have an ugly kid. Even if it's true, they did everything they could to prevent it, and it's too late to do anything about it now. You know, it's one thing to tell your friends. I think by all means, tell your friends if you think one of my books is no good, because that's how we find good books, is through recommendations. But don't tell me. I don't need to know if you didn't like my books.
Thanks so much to my guest, Cory Doctorow. You can download most of Cory's work for free from his website, corydoctorowscraphound.com. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.